From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when Samantha Bee referred to Ivanka Trump with a crude term the likes of which I cannot say on the radio. This is a term that is used often, and in politics it has been deployed regularly, for example, against Hillary Clinton. Ted Nugent referred to Hillary Clinton with that term and then got invited to the White House by the same people who were so offended by Samantha Bee. Anyway, Samantha Bee's invocation of the term was met with all kinds of opprobrium from the political right, who feigned outrage, and from the political left, who essentially argued that that kind of thing was probably not productive or uncivil. Bee is a commentator, and she's a comedian. She's hardly the first to use crude language, but did she cross a line? Comedians are often considered truth tellers, but lately, are we seeing comedy become just another component of tribalism? This hour, a conversation about crossing lines, when to do it, when not to, how to know. And my guests come from the Rochester comedy scene. I'm going to give you a shorthand introduction to all of them, but you can find them in very many different places, whether they're doing stand-up on their own, sketch comedy on their own, et cetera, et cetera. John Forrest Thompson teaches improv at the Focus Theater in Rochester, among other things. John, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Woody Battaglia teaches stand-up at the Focus. He runs just about every open mic in town. Nice to see you, Woody.
I mean, there's a couple. There's a couple I don't.
To be fair.
I want to be fair to all the other great hosts making great comedy happen in Rochester.
Oh, that's very sweet. Well, welcome back, Woody. Thank you. Andrea Springer is the host of a new podcast called Helpless Romantics. Where is that? When are we going to find it?
You can find that on Apple Podcasts, and then we're also on SoundCloud.
Nice to have you back. Thanks for having me.
So I
guess in general, what I want to start with you is just a question on what kind of jokes, if any, are out of line. Woody?
What kind of jokes are out of line? Well, none is the broad answer is none, right? You're going to say things.
It can be none.
Yeah, it's none.
Look, and it's funny because I have a reputation as being a person who will shut things down. Like there is a joke that is correct for some specific audience somewhere, right? So the issue is, what is the audience? What is the context of what you're saying? Some jokes are inappropriate for certain audiences in that people will not find them funny. People will be offended or hurt by them. You know, people will find these things to be triggering of past trauma, for example, or they'll find them to be in bad taste or whatever. But there's a venue for every joke. It is the comedian's job to know their audience and know where the line is with the audiences that they speak to.
Okay. Andrea, you agree? No real line there?
I agree to an extent. I think my big thing that I keep coming back to is definitely like punching down versus punching up. So I'm not a fan at all of somebody who's punching down, somebody who's in a position of any kind of power or privilege, and then they're using that to belittle people that have less power or less privilege than them. I could say that I think that anytime you're punching up, it's usually all right.
Okay. And in the case of Samantha Bee, she was punching up at Ivanka?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. John?
Yeah, I come from a school. I think there are lines. There's every time. For me, Carlin is kind of George Carlin is the gold standard for this, right? Because I think he's the only comedian that's gone to the Supreme Court or an issue involving like a comedian's act. But he always said, find that line. Right, his job is to find that line. He wanted to go across it, but I think the genius in what he did is he found a way to carry people across that line with him.
You're going to hear a soundbite in just a moment that we've pulled of him saying exactly that. But what I want to do, I want to key in on exactly what John's saying because what Carlin seems to be saying, what you're about to hear in a moment, is he wants to sort of offend the audience. He wants to make them feel something that is beyond just ha-ha, go, whoa.
Right.
But I think it's probably more than just say something offensive and then tell people to get over it. The question is, how do you sort of thread this needle? So there's a lot that Carlin says here. This is obviously the late George Carlin, and he's talking to the late Charlie Rose. Well, he's not the late. This is when he had a career. Let's listen.
We've all seen a lot of comedians who seem to have a political bent in their work. And always implicit in the work is some positive outcome, that this is all going to work. If only we do this, if only we pass that bill, if only we elect him, if only we do that. It's not true. It's circling the drain time for humans. I believe this. I honestly believe this. Not just as a comedian, he thinks that. He likes to say that. Yeah. I believe it. And when you say to yourself, I don't care what happens, it just gives you a broader perspective for the art, for the words to emerge, to not care. That's what happened in that 92 show. That's why I could say the planet is fine, the people are... Because the planet will outlast us. It will be here, and it will be fine.
Has the subject matter changed?
Well, I you're still stuck with what's going on. Yeah. But I don't like topical. I don't like political humor. I don't mention politicians. In fact, I defend them in this particular show. Everyone is on their case. Everyone is always making things.
Politicians are bad.
I defend them and blame it on the people. This is where it belongs.
Yes. You get what you deserve?
Yes, you get what you deserve, and you deserve what you get. And I have a slogan, the public sucks. And it works nicely, and people accept it. Not very enthusiastically, but they understand that it says we the people in that preamble. It doesn't say them the thises and those the thats.
It's us.
It says, hey.
We got on this boat.
And people who hate government are involved in a form of suicide, because government is self-government. And if you hate the government, you hate yourself.
Yeah.
It's the same with the war against nature that mankind goes through. So I just said to myself, it's not going to get better, not in my lifetime. Let me enjoy this and get a little perverse about my commentary on it.
What does perverse mean, though?
Well, to look for where the people think the line is. The people have values, that these things, these amorphous things they call values, that they bring to the seat in the theater when they sit down. Yeah. And I like to find out where their line may be and deliberately cross it, disturb them a little, make them uncomfortable, and then bring them with me across the line and make them glad they came. That's what I do. I'm an entertainer. I'm not a doomsayer. I'm not here to preach. I don't do political tracts. But I do entertain. I do a lot of jokes. But I want you to feel a little in danger along the way.
All right. So let's talk to our guests here in studio about what they think Carlin is. And we're going to work backwards because there's a lot that he said there. But George Carlin at the end saying he wants to, he didn't use the word offend. He wanted to make the audience feel uncomfortable, to go beyond the audience's line, then drag them across and make them glad they came. That is a hard trick to pull, I think, John. And I think it's getting harder, because once someone is offended these days, people tend to use that offense as kind of a weapon. So
I think the feedback has changed with social media, right? I think it equals everyone out, that people you normally wouldn't listen to, you know, with social media. You know, like he said, pulling the people across the line with him or bringing them with them, that's a nuanced way, as opposed to like an Andrew Dice Clay who just wants to offend, right? That's closer to like performance art. So I think it's...
And it's a character. I mean, that...
It is.
It's but, Andrew Silverstein.
right, but the comedy is meant to make people uncomfortable. In education, we call it rigor, right?
Yeah.
You don't want something to be too hard, so a kid shuts down, and you don't want it to be too easy so they don't learn anything. And I think comedy has to find that same rigor.
Oh, I would totally agree with that. And also, and I agree with Andrea about punching up, punching down. Like, punching down is where all of the problems have, like, that's what people are upset about, is that you're picking on somebody who, I mean, it's a why don't you pick on someone your own size situation or bigger. You know, I mean, it's a noble thing to take on you know, the people in power, I think, or the groups that are traditionally in power, and to maybe not attack groups that traditionally have been kicked around. I think it's harder to, and I think that, of course, there's, and something's going to be funny to everybody, and there's ways to, and like you're saying, you know, there's a zone in which you can play with these things and not make people feel that you're just trying to make them feel bad. Like, there's some comics that will get on stage, and I experience this all the time, because we see people, especially people who are just starting in comedy, where what they are trying to do is get any reaction at all, and they're okay if the reaction isn't laughter and instead the reaction is people cringing or genuinely feeling bad. And I just think that there's some people who look at the stand-up platform as just a way for them to express their terrible ideas to people.
And I keep thinking back to what Andrea said about the difference between punching down and up. So we can't ask George Carlin anymore, but one of the things I'm imagining him thinking when he talks about figuring out where the audience's line is and then crossing it isn't just, I'm going to offend you with something sexist or racist or, you know, misogynistic. It may be offending someone's own sensibilities of themselves, taking them down a notch, you know, and making them feel responsible for some of society's ills in the same way that he's saying, oh, you don't like the government? You are the government. You chose the government. So I'm speaking too broadly there, but I'm thinking of the difference between punching up and down there. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, definitely. I think that part of the danger comes when you take any kind of audience or public, as he said, and put them all in the seat of like, oh no, like the poor victims of like whatever like thing the comedian is doing to them. Whereas I think they probably, a lot of audience members probably have a lot of problematic views and ideas that maybe do need to be challenged.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, what Lenny Bruce, you know, the power lies with the suppressed, right? So that's why you don't see a whole lot of, I mean, yeah, we have conservative comedians, but not really topical conservative comedians.
It's very hard to be a conservative comedian because you're literally what you're doing, and if you're a conservative, is you're espousing the beliefs of the few. So it's like, yeah, it's very hard to get a whole audience on your side. Well, yeah, or the beliefs of the, like, your...
My 70-year-old uncle does a killer 10 minutes at Thanksgiving in the middle of Iowa every year.
Right, exactly. Right. That's what I'm saying.
It would not play anywhere else.
No, it wouldn't. Right. And
but there he kills.
Sure.
It's on fire, man.
Those are his people.
And I think our conservative listeners are going to take issue with Woody saying that if you're a conservative, you're espousing the beliefs of the few.
No, what
Dennis
I'm saying
Miller
is...
was a conservative comedian all through the 90s. And it was Clinton who was the butt of it.
You know, right.
Dennis Miller hasn't changed much. That's his problem.
Why no.
He's not, you know, but before...
And he really, you know, doubled down after 9/11. He, like, I saw him on The Tonight Show jumping up and down, yelling that we should be dropping more bombs on Iraq.
Yeah. So, but, I mean, I think he's more of a pundit now. But, I mean, when Clinton was the butt of all of it, it was still the same guy. So, yeah, I think with Samantha Bee, and what I would be curious to know is, was there a conscious choice about using that specific word? Because I think she changes four letters, changes a word, and it doesn't happen. That controversy doesn't happen. And I wonder if she was aware of that prior.
Oh, man, you said controversy for a second. I thought you were actually, we're going to have to go to the delay. I suspect she chose that word very specifically.
Yeah. That's super deliberate.
And so let's listen a little bit of what Samantha Bee had to say about why she was apologizing and whom she didn't and didn't to. Let's listen to some of that.
It is a word I have used on the show many times, hoping to reclaim it. This time, I used it as an insult. I crossed the line, I regret it, and I do apologize for that. The problem is that many women have heard that word at the worst moments of their lives. A lot of them don't want that word reclaimed. They want it gone. And I don't blame them. I don't want to inflict more pain on them. I want this show to be challenging and I want it to be honest, but I never intended it to hurt anyone except Ted Cruz. Many men were also offended by my use of the word. I do not care about that. And look, if you are worried about the death of civility, don't sweat it. I'm a comedian. People who hone their voices in basement bars while yelling back at drunk hecklers are definitely not paragons of civility. I am. I'm really sorry that I said that word, but you know what? Civility is just nice words. Maybe we should all worry a little bit more about the niceness of our actions.
All right, so I want to ask our guests if they thought, number one, she should have apologized, and number two, if that was sort of hitting the mark. Andrea?
As a woman, it's kind of her right to claim that word if she wants to. It wasn't necessarily wrong for her to apologize because I listened to her apology. I thought her apology was right on the mark. I thought, she can apologize to the women that do just feel really traumatized by that word. I don't think that she should have apologized to any of the men that were offended about it because it's never been used against them in the same way that it's used against women.
John?
Yeah, you know, I think it was sincere and genuine. You know, she touched on civility. I think it's more than would come from the other side, if that's the way you look at it. I think if she thought she should apologize, I think her reasoning behind it was great. I think it's fine that she apologized for it. I'd really like the explanation behind it. And, you know, I think she's also has an obligation because she does a commercial show, right? So she has customers and bosses. So I think there's that side of it as well. I'm not saying that that she was selling out and doing it for that reason. It sounded sincere, but
would you have apologized?
Yeah, if I genuinely offended someone like that, and I think when she spoke about the women who have, you know,
hold on, when you say someone like that, you mean women, not necessarily Ivanka Trump? You wouldn't apologize to Ivanka Trump?
No. No, I wouldn't apologize to Ivanka Trump. I would be sorry that if women took it that way, that had been traumatized in the past and it brought up a horrible experience and my actions had caused that. That's what I would be sorry for. But no, Ivanka Trump, she's a big woman. She can hold her own. Look, I mean, I can't imagine the conversation she's had with her father in private or what she's heard. So, you know.
And I think that it would have been a problem had John Thompson made that joke rather than Samantha Bee, John Thompson being a man.
Yeah. You know, Chappelle does this bit, right, about it's an old blind black man who doesn't realize that he's black because he's blind and he's a super huge racist, right? So, and it's a bit that he does. And, you know, it's interesting to see because people on the left love that and people on the right love it too, but they love it for different reasons.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, you know, that's kind of an interesting bit in terms of how your comedy can affect the different sides as well.
Okay. Woody, would you have apologized?
I probably would have apologized. First of all, me as a man, I'm never going to say that. I'm never going to use that word. I am never going to make that joke. It's not my joke to make. If a woman is looking at a woman in power and wants to use any tool at their disposal, I think that that's totally fine. I do think that when you tell a joke, like I said at the beginning, there's a percentages game. And I don't mean to make it cynical. Like, I care about people, and I'm not trying to say that, oh, jokes don't matter and words don't matter. They totally matter, and words will hurt people. You have to make a decision every time you make a joke. Am I hurting somebody by telling this joke? Am I willing to risk hurting people? Do I think that there's a greater good or a greater value to what I'm saying beyond someone's initial shock or maybe somebody feeling a little queasy about it? I think that it's totally well within her rights to either apologize or not apologize. I agree with John that she works for a giant corporation, and the apology might be forthcoming by order from her boss. But that said, I think that she apologized on her own terms. I think that she made a lot of good points in the course of having to apologize, and I think that it all came out. I think in the wash, it came out as a positive thing. I don't think she should be made to apologize, but I do think that if she's hurting women and she wants to clarify, look, you weren't the target of this joke. I'm sorry that this joke hurt you. What I was trying to do was attack one of the most powerful people on planet Earth right now.
She's a public servant. She just made $82 million last year.
Yeah, exactly. And on top of it, like, the weapons that a comedian has are words, and the weapons that Ivanka Trump and her family have are nuclear weapons. So we're throwing pebbles at a monolith here.
Okay, but now let me ask, why use a word like that in the first place? The critics from the left were saying this is not advancing the cause. This is only going to make walls go up higher. Samantha Bee wanted to take Ivanka Trump down a peg because she's been disappointed because Ivanka Trump has massive opportunity to actually make good in the world. And Samantha Bee's assessment is that Ivanka Trump has failed and has been a massive hypocrite who is personally profiting. That's Samantha Bee's. I'm just observing. So she used that word. But does that... why use the word in the first place? Is it too easy, in a sense, to use a word like that? Andrea?
I'm a big proponent of any marginalized group of people being able to reclaim any word that they want, because it is, that is, for example, a word with such a history that I think that it's she's earned it, and women have earned it in a way. With that word in general, I keep going back to the episode of 30 Rock where one of Tina Fey's male employees calls her that word. And she makes the point that there's no word that can be used against a man, for example, that has the same kind of impact, and that's it's like that by design. So I don't necessarily know if I would use the word in my comedy, but I think she's earned it and she's made it there.
Okay, John.
Well, I think it goes back to Carlin again, right? The seven words you can't say on TV. Because prior to that, it was just Lenny Bruce and things were obscene, right? But when it got to Carlin and those words and the way that he was literally challenging language, was what are you mad about? Are you mad about the word? Or are you mad about the sentiment behind the word? You know, and he used the example, I'm not going to say anything that I can't say. So you guys agree about that. But, you know,
I see Rob, you know, over there. He's ready with
like
he's
every
ready
morning I wake up to a, you know, a cock that crows, right?
Perfectly fine to say on the radio right now. If I say like every morning, you know,
right. If he's yeah,
something else, same word
context,
what are you offended by? And that's what I would ask. Like, everyone's really freaked out about this specific word, but are they as freaked out about the sentiment behind it?
Right. And I think that it's a powerful word, and it is meant to, I mean, it was meant to wake somebody up. It's meant to make sure that you're paying attention to what she's saying. It's a special delivery system for the message of the joke. And if you want Ivanka Trump or people in power or America to listen, you might package your joke as a missile like that. Now, you know, and I agree with Andrea about reclaiming words. I think it's her right to use the word. She wants to use the word. I think that it would have less impact on a stage in front of a regular audience because there is no prohibition. You can say whatever you want on a stage and the cops are not going to come like in Lenny Bruce's time. And you know, she can say it on basic cable. Their standards allowed it through. So that's, you know, but it's still right there on the edge. It's like, it's a thing that you wouldn't have said 10 years ago on basic cable. So I think that she's using the tools that she has in her box right now.
All right. So listeners, if you want to call the program, 844-295-TALK, it's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI. If you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We're talking about comedy, its power, whether there are lines to be crossed and what that looks like. And before we get beyond Carlin, we've spent a lot of time kind of talking about, I think John Forrest Thompson seems to go to the church of Carlin.
I love Carlin.
But I want to at least ask, even if maybe you get the sense that Samantha Bee was at least a little unfairly pressured to apologize, or people who are feigning outrage, and let's just be blunt about it. If you don't mind Ted Nugent calling Hillary Clinton the same word and he gets invited to the White House and you're upset about this, you're being hypocritical. And so there's a lot of feigned outrage. And again, outrage can be weaponized. Taking offense can be weaponized. It happens in politics and it happens in lots of spheres of American life. But I'm not sure that Samantha Bee accomplished what George Carlin described in that interview that we played earlier, which is that you find the line, you cross it intentionally, but then you pull people across and make them glad that they went with you. Or maybe she did, because I think that's a difficult trick to pull, as we've been saying. And Andrea, if that's the standard, was Samantha Bee accomplishing it, or did she miss?
I think that the problem with accomplishing that is that the people who are on board with it were and would have already been on board with it.
Yeah, the same way that Robert De Niro, you know, saying F Trump at the Tonys gets a big rousing cheer, but that's not very brave. You know,
right.
I mean, good for you, I guess.
Right.
But all that does is it plays with people who support the president as saying, well, look at the liberal elite. And I actually think that does more to galvanize them than anything. But so anyway, so the B stuff sort of plays to the base.
Yeah, I think it ends up being kind of an echo chamber in a way that isn't particularly helpful to any cause. I think that she didn't really say anything that made people think, and maybe that's the problem, because if you're going to go over that line with somebody that you haven't gone over before, it's because something new has been exposed to you, and I don't think that anything new was really exposed to the audience in that line.
I tend to agree. John?
Yeah, I think when you look at it, Samantha Bee, Colbert, they all have an agenda, right? They're hoping, right? They're obviously not Trump folks. So there are other comedians that don't have agendas, right? So I think that's part of her thing. So, you know, I think she was playing to the base and probably also trying to rattle the cage a little bit or poke the bear. So, I think you'd have to ask her what did she set out to accomplish when she wrote that joke? That's what I was trying to ask. Like, when she wrote it, like, did she think it would be this big? Was she prepared for that? Or, you know, that's the insight that I would really like to know if she accomplished. Man, she got a ton of press, and people are talking about it socially. You know, it spawned all kinds of conversations. And, yeah, so I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
Okay. Woody?
I think there'd probably be less controversy if it were the best, funniest joke that you could possibly think of. Like, that's the thing. Like, people are there. The outrage level versus the humor level is they're usually opposed to each other. So it's like, so if your joke is super edgy or over the line in some way that some people would think, if it's so funny, if there's something about it that is so entertaining and irrefutably, this is a great joke, then you're going to get a lot less controversy off it. You're going to get more people entertained. So it's like, I think that probably their miscalculation was that they maybe used it unwisely. They used it in the wrong spot or whatever. As she said, she'd said the word many times before. This time she used it just to say this person is a, basically. And so that's, you know, that's name calling. Name calling isn't exactly the greatest humor. So, like, is it entertaining? I feel like that's literally just picking on somebody, which I think is fine if it's Ivanka Trump. I think it's fine to pick on Ivanka Trump. But is it funny and entertaining? Maybe not so much.
Well, and actually, what was the punchline? Like, what was the joke? Right? It wasn't the word, right?
Yeah, no.
It was, right? It's always that kind of you're trying to reveal hypocrisy. Right,
yeah,
the
yeah.
joke. So, yeah, it's a little misguided in terms of what people are even talking about in terms of what was she trying to illuminate.
Right. That's true, too. But it's like if you just pull the little bit of whatever, then it's, yeah. And that's the other thing. It's like context. You know, when people hear about these things, they hear about them and they don't necessarily watch the whole thing. Or, you know, stuff gets taken in a weird way. And sometimes in the context of a larger piece, then it all makes a lot more sense and it all seems a lot more forgivable, even to a person who might be offended by the use of the word, you know?
I'm going to get Casey in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Casey.
Hello, everybody. I'm listening to this conversation, and it's striking me that we've lost the finesse. We've lost the ability. We've lost the fine use of the language to be able to say what we want to say without having to go for that immediate shock. You know, it's no more than a Howard Stern moment, if you will, where years ago, someone like Will Rogers and some of these satirists could go out there and cut people to shreds and ribbons and not be vulgar about things. I'll let you guys comment. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Casey. Let's go around the table. What do you guys think?
I do think that there's a point to be had where Woody was talking earlier about like new stand-ups going up.
Oh, my goodness.
And they go up and they want to do what Carlin did, but the problem is that they're not Carlin. And they're like...
Do you see that often?
Oh, yeah.
Like, almost every night that
every
I
night,
host
yeah.
a show. When it's new comics or when I teach a class, we talk a lot about punching up versus punching down. That's like a huge segment of the first session I would do with the students, because you want to get your terms right, and you want to let people know, like, yeah, there's a context for every joke, but guess what? You're not good at this yet. So maybe you want to stick to things that are more. Maybe you need to learn how to tell a joke before you learn how to be super duper edgy, because that's, I think of that as varsity level stuff. To work your way up to being good enough where you're using those things wisely. You know, you wouldn't start somebody on their first day doing a task doing the hardest level of that task.
Okay, so but Andrea, in many ways it sounds like that vulgarity in the mind of a young comedian is the comedy is they, or at least they seem to think that's what's funny.
Yeah, and that's not if you look at any joke, the joke isn't like, oh, the word that they used is gross and that's funny. Mm-hmm. But I think, I do think that there's some really, really great comedy that can have a lot of vulgarity in it.
Yeah. Okay. John?
Yeah, I think it's context. I mean, and there's different, you know, genres, obviously. I mean, there's plenty of comics working now that aren't vulgar and are funny and they sell tons of tickets. I think the change is, you know, Will Rogers' time, you know, a lot of times that was an act and you did your act and it was an hour. And, you know, and I think comedy changed in the 60s with people really putting themselves out there. And, you know, talking about Stern, you know, a 14-year-old boy loves Stern because he uses those words and the content. But older people like him because of the honesty and the access that he gets to people to talk about themselves in a real, authentic way.
Yeah. Like when Donald Trump talked about sneaking into changing rooms to him when Miss Team USA was there.
Right. Uh-huh. Right.
He was willing to tell the truth about that.
Yeah.
Or talking about his
feelings. I wish I was making that up.
Doctors, or his daughter, doctor. His daughter's attractiveness. Talk that was also on Stern.
Yeah.
And by the way, Corey, who called in, like, Howard Stern's been around for 40 years plus, so I don't think things just changed overnight, you know? I think we've been living in the era of modern comedy this entire time, like since the birth of the comedy club in the late 70s.
I don't disagree, but I think it's still fair to ask, is that the best form of comedy? Is that what we should aspire to?
Oh, no, I don't think it's what we should aspire to. No. I think the best comedy is interesting and smart and that there's a lot going on. I think that the base level, and like we talk about people starting out doing stand-up, and some people never get over it. But the idea that you're only doing things for shock value, sometimes when people start, the reason that they gravitate towards that stuff is because that's all they have, because they haven't figured out how to write jokes yet. So instead of presenting jokes, they are just thinking, oh, well, I'll say this. I say an outrageous thing, and people might laugh nervously, or people might boo or whatever. But that's the only reaction they can think to engender.
And I will say too, I come from a literature background, and I think I liken some of the stuff that's happening in comedy now to like Sylvia Plath and confessional poetry. So I think comedy has gotten in a direction where it's a lot more confessional now.
And oh, yeah.
I think the vulgarity is kind of part of that, just because if you're confessing things about your life, there are things in your life that are vulgar.
Yeah. Well, and I think what I don't know who it was, 60s, I forget what the book was, Kessler or something. Anyway, it was like jester versus poet, right? Like a jester is going to tell jokes, right? And they're funny and they should be well constructed and they make people laugh. And I look at like Jeff Foxworthy, right? He puts together great jokes. They're funny. They're not offensive. They're generally not topical.
Yeah.
And, you know, or Brian Regan or Gaffigan that talks about his family or something like that. But the more ideas you put behind it, you know, then it starts to become less of a jester and you start to get into more of a philosopher type poet.
It's very, very true. And all these things are, I find all styles of comedy to be valid. And then there's some people who are edgy, who have carved out the niche for their audience, and the people who go to see them or the people who watch whatever they do are people who are expecting that kind of thing. And so that's fine. Like, that's a thing that is in its own closed loop, and who cares? Like, I don't care that mm-hmm. Anthony Jeselnik is making, you know, horrifying jokes, but he's doing it to his audience who are coming because that's what they would like to see, because they want to be zinged in that way. So,
well, I hold on just one second, because I'm late for only break, but Patrick in Rochester, we're going to get your phone call after our only break of the hour, because he wants to weigh in on this whole Sam B versus George Carlin and the biggest difference he sees that he thinks the panel hasn't touched on. We're going to get to that in just a second. And I do want to go back to, I'm stuck on Carlin, but when he said, I don't care anymore, I actually don't find that all that healthy. And I... Certainly, you wouldn't say Samantha Bee doesn't care. She cares. Stephen Colbert cares. I mean, and I think there's something valuable in people in comedy caring. But maybe I'm being overly idealistic.
I care too much.
So we'll ask our guests when we come back here. So let's get that break. We're talking comedy, crossing the line, when and when not to do it, with Andrea Springer, Woody Battaglia, John Forrest Thompson, and we're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, we're broadcasting live from our sister station WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio in Geneva, and we're going to talk to a Finger Lakes writer whose specialty is in bees. We're going to answer your questions about the bees in your backyard, what kind they might be, where they've all gone and why, and what we should do when we encounter them. The story of bees, Friday on Connections. And welcome back to Connections. Patrick in Rochester, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks for the conversation. It's very interesting. And I just think that it's less about the words, and I think it's more about a function of the tribal, the political tribalism that we're experiencing. And all the comedians, whether, you know, whether it's Roseanne Barr, Michelle Wolf, or Samantha Bee, I think the fundamental mistake you're making is this same thing we try to teach our kids. You know, are you laughing with you or laughing at you? And I think these comedians are inviting their audience to laugh at the other side, and they're not inviting them to laugh the other side to share laughing with each other. You know, George Carlin made us laugh at ourselves or laugh with ourselves, and Jeff Foxworthy, who you just mentioned, you know, the people who laugh the hardest at his jokes are the rednecks that he describes. So I just think that it's the tribalism that's really at issue here, is that we're not really inviting each other to laugh about our own foibles. If you go back to All in the Family and compare that to the Roseanne Barr show that just went off the air, I mean, nobody knew Carol O'Connor's politics. I mean, but we all have to know Samantha Bee's and Roseanne's politics. And I think it's unfortunate that a comedian's politics are now a part of their identity and now a part of their humor.
Patrick,
that's just a comment I have.
Yeah, thank you, Patrick. I'm not the professional in the room. I've got three really well-studied and respected people on the local comedy scene. Just as an observer, I think there's something really powerful in what Patrick just said there, because, excuse me, when Carlin tells the audience, you want to complain about the government, you are the government, you're the idiots who elected these people, he's calling his audience idiots, he's making them laugh, and then having them hopefully realize about themselves, okay. Again, I'm picking one joke. I'm not looking at his entire body of work. But it does feel that most of the material, pick any comedian, no matter what their political ideology is, most of the laughs they're aiming for are getting their audience, who probably agree with them, to laugh at the people who are the ostensible idiots who have a different view of the world. And I think Patrick's point there, it resonated with me. John, does it resonate with you? Is there a point there? Is he overstating it?
Not at all. I think, you know, as I mentioned before, the audience is different in the feedback in terms of social media, is different. I mean, you've got bots and trolls that inflate it on both sides, you know, not to mention just, how emboldened we are to say something on Twitter that we wouldn't say to someone's face, right? Like a neighbor down the street or something like that. And I think Patrick made a great point. I think the silos that we're living in right now is probably heightening this a little bit, but it can't be much different than it was in the 60s, you know, when socially things were kind of on fire like that. And I think that's art tends to get better in periods like this, and then it'll flatten out. You know, moderate art in the middle that everyone kind of likes tends to get boring, and then it'll flare out to the edges a little bit.
I think there's a real risk to not being able to laugh at ourselves. And we are at a time where all of the data shows that we are spending less time with people who disagree with us. We live farther away from people who disagree with us. We don't really watch the shows from people with different political ideology. We don't watch the comedy from people with different political ideology. And if we're not making fun of ourselves, we get so self-righteous, we think, well, our view is the perfect truth, and no one could be criticizing it. I mean, Anthony Bourdain, and we're going to talk about it more this summer when we bring back the Summer of Food on Connections. Anthony Bourdain used to say that, man, the people who can't laugh at themselves the most are the vegans and the craft beer lovers.
That's so true.
And now the vegans and the craft beer lovers are going to call me and yell at me for that, which I have so much love for you, vegans and craft beer lovers. So much love. I love vegan cooking and I love craft beer. But the notion is that we can't laugh at ourselves. And so I think there's danger there. And I'm a big fan of comedians who get us to laugh at ourselves a little bit and take ourselves a little less seriously.
And I think what was interesting about Roseanne this time around with the reboot, I really enjoyed the show. I thought it was pretty good. And I wondered how the flyover states would handle, you know, having a granddaughter of a different color and you know, a grandson that was dealing with his gender issues and that kind of thing. I mean, Roseanne, they, you know, that was part of that show too. And I think that's why people maybe on the left tuned in.
Right.
Because they like that kind of thing. And then, but I mean, some of the subject matter that they dealt with this time around, that she was joking about illegally getting all those prescription drugs, you know, and, it, I mean, that was interesting and kind of, you know, people were worried about far different things. And I thought, wow, well, that was a pretty powerful issue that she just tackled. And nobody's really talking about that.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's a tragedy of this situation with Roseanne, is all the potential squandered, and that could have been a thing where it was a meeting of the minds, or that we were really hashing it out, and you had strong people. Like, but I think that they made a caricature of the Laurie Metcalf character. You know, so I think that she ended up being a straw man for conservatives to hate. And so, but they did do those other things that you mentioned that were good. So it was like, you know, you just wish that somebody understood what the opportunity that they had and the platform that they had, and didn't, you know, toss it in the garbage like she did.
Andrea?
So to go back a little, backtrack a little bit, just to talk more a little bit about Patrick's point, I think there is, I guess, kind of, and this isn't necessarily based on anything that anybody said, but there's something that kind of goes off in my head when it's, oh, we look, oh, Carlin, good. Jeff Foxworthy, good. Samantha Bee, bad.
And I hope that's not the framing, because I think Samantha Bee is brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
I felt that way,
there's,
too.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a, like, a Mean Girls thing that I want to kind of stay away from.
I think that's fair.
Where I think people are a lot harder on female comics if they're mean than they're on male comics.
Very true.
Like you mentioned earlier, with the word and who can say it and who can't.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are valid criticisms to be made, especially about Roseanne. But I think it's tough to make those criticisms in that kind of vacuum if you're not criticizing everyone.
Okay, thank you for the reality check there, by the way, on the difference in gender, because I think it's really fair, and it definitely strikes me as something I should have thought about earlier this hour. Gabe writes to us and says, as a huge comedy fan, I take exception with the idea that swearing is just a crutch in comedy. The funniest thing I ever saw was Eddie Murphy's raw stand-up routine, which was groundbreaking at the time. Comedians reflect parts of our psyche that we try to keep hidden. The swearing can be part of it.
But Eddie Murphy is a fantastic physical and vocal comedian, and that's a big part of it too. If I were just to say the word with no inflection standing up here, then it wouldn't be funny. It would just be like, oh, that's weird.
Well, yeah, and also you can like Eddie Murphy, you can enjoy that, but watch Raw or Delirious now, and just, you know, you can play homophobia and misogyny drinking game and be in the hospital before the end of the hour.
John writes to us, not John Forrest Thompson. John says, Samantha Bee took a page out of Donald Trump's playbook, and that there's no such thing as bad publicity. This went through editors and others on the show, and the resulting controversy likely came as no surprise, and it probably won't have a negative impact on her professionally. I think that's probably right. I think that, you know, she's earned a lot of attention for this, and my guess is she's, at least for the moment, got a bigger audience than she did before. Well, and we'll see what comes out of that. I want to listen to some of what somebody who definitely didn't take himself too seriously and doesn't take himself too seriously, partially because he's British, and that's part of the British ethos, is to never take yourself too seriously. And that's John Cleese, who was a guest of this program last week. He's coming to Rochester in late July for a special showing of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And then he likes to do these Q&As. And he's done it all across the country. And he had some observations for us on Americans and sometimes our inability to detect irony and to take things a little too literally compared to UK viewers. And so let's listen to some of what John Cleese had to say.
Yeah, I think that kind of very vulgar abuse doesn't get anyone anywhere. But I think if you make a deep joke, I mean, there was a magnificent joke last week, and that is this. Kim, what's her name? Kardashian.
Yeah.
Went to the White House to discuss prison reform with the President of the United States. No, I mean, jokes don't get any funnier.
That's John Cleese. And he had a chance to kind of elaborate a little bit and said there are different parts of the country where different people get different things. And he thinks irony doesn't always play well in this country, and he's got to be very careful with that. And I wonder if our guests agree with Cleese on that point.
I totally agree with John Cleese on that. Because the if it's never more apparent when people, like I'm talking about things being taken out of context, people not understanding the whole thing. This is also true with things like irony or sarcasm, where you'll read something in text form, which we all are doing on Twitter, or people pulling quotes out of things, and it looks like somebody said X, but really that wasn't the intent, and that's not what they meant, and they had a whole, like, there was a joke to it. And people not understanding that things are a joke, it's like when you're, I mean, I want to be charitable and say your older relative, sometimes not your older relative, will share an Onion article and say, this is terrible.
Or a member of Congress, which is happening.
Oh, yeah, member of Congress. Oh, it's happened more than once. Where they don't understand this is a joke. This isn't real. Like, where people just don't have critical thinking skills about. They're not. I think it's that people aren't ever asking what was the intent of this, and they're just reading into whatever the surface level thing is, and that's there's an unsophisticated understanding of comedy at a time when the people doing comedy are more sophisticated than they ever have been in the history of comedy.
And so John Forrest Thompson is someone who teaches comedy at the Focus Theater. If a student or actor wants to play a student, you got an actor in comedy, and they want to play a character that's racist to make a point, but you're concerned that the audience might not get it, would you advise against it sort of at this kind of little moment we're in?
No, you know, I would always encourage somebody to go for it, but I, you know, we always say to play at the top of your intelligence, right? So what, if you're going to play a racist character, you should have some intent, and I would say 99 times out of a million, you know, or whatever, you're going to have to probably make a racist look bad, right? You're not going to raise them up, so... you know, a caller mentioned Archie Bunker. It's a perfect example, right? So that was somebody we could all pick on, but was very self-aware that we also loved, right? So, I would say go for it, but we always say pay the tax. You're going to pay the tax for what decisions you make in a scene, right? So the scene, from an improv perspective, when you're making up stuff as you go along, that kind of thing. So it may bomb, or you might get yourself into a situation where it's very uncomfortable, or you're going to have to dig yourself out of a hole. But I would say, you know, go for it. But, you know, it's that punch up, punch down that Andrea mentioned earlier. Are you punching up or are you punching down? You should know that if you wade into that kind of territory.
So John was actually my improv teacher many moons ago, and one of the things that he taught me that I really thought of when we were kind of bringing up this question is treat your audience like poets and geniuses. So I guess I would have to say, in a certain way, I disagree with that. I think the audience has a lot more credit. They deserve a lot more credit for being able to understand certain things, and not necessarily like your aunt on Facebook. But if you're going to a comedy show, I think a lot of times you will be able to kind of rise to the occasion of like understanding the things that the performers are doing.
Yeah, and I would agree with that totally, and also say that the live comedy audience is the best comedy audience. When you're watching something after the fact on video, or you're listening to a thing, or you're reading what somebody said, you're not actually getting the experience. Like, you literally have to go see comedy to experience comedy. Everything else is a diluted, hazy version.
Go live. Mm-hmm. Go see it live.
I mean it literally as in, like, if you want to understand things like the irony of the thing that somebody said, or whatever, or if somebody's making, like, you can tell in the room, and you can convey that better in the room.
All right, so in our last minute plus here, just 20 seconds apiece, George Carlin said late in his career he stopped really caring about the outcomes, about the human race, about politics. He would become a cynic, and it made his comedy easier. And I wonder how you feel about that.
I think that would make not just my comedy, but my life harder. I think caring is the most important thing that somebody can do.
Yeah, I kind of agreed with that, John. I kind of agree with Andrea there. It made me a little sad to hear someone that cynical.
Yeah, I don't think I necessarily believe him 100%. I think he was doing that consciously when he was creating his art. But I think it was so ingrained in him of who he was in terms of a rebel, in terms of being smart and socially conscious. You can't turn all of that off. I mean, he was, Comedy, you're facing your own mortality, right? And the best comics do that to you. He gets you a little uncomfortable, and then you think about it. And how do I really think about this?
So right. You're saying that's a form of still caring. Okay, so you didn't fully buy it, Woody?
Yeah, I agree with John. I can hear him playing to his audience with that kind of statement. Of course you care. He's out there. I mean, at the time, he was installed in Vegas doing stuff, and you're entertaining an audience.
All right, so what do we learn this hour? We're going to punch up instead of punching down. We're not going to be so upset if comedians are punching up. We're not going to try to drag them just for maybe seeing where the line is. We're going to be a little less offendable ourselves and a little more open to comedians who take risks, and we're going to try to laugh at ourselves, too.
Be smart.
Sounds good to me.
And I'm going to go to all your classes at The Focus and learn a little bit more. So you can see Andrea Springer. You can hear her. A new podcast is called Helpless Romantics. Andrea, great to have you back. Thanks for being here. Thank you so much. John Forrest Thompson and Woody Battaglia both teach at The Focus Theater in Rochester. Good to have both of you. Thanks for taking the time to be here, John. Good to see you.
Oh, it was totally my pleasure.
Thanks, Woody. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow.